Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Sleep and the Rhythms of Life Project at the University of Oxford. I'm Sally Shuttleworth, and I'm here to introduce our two guests who will be in conversation today. First, Russell Foster, who's Professor of Circadian Neuroscience at the University of Oxford, and author of the best-selling book, Lifetime, The New Science of the Body Clock and How It Can Revolutionise Your Health. And second, Ian Ritchie, a world-renowned architect, artist and author, whose work begins with light as the primary material of architecture. Sleep occupies about one-third of our lives, and since the pandemic has been a particular focus of concern, and indeed anxiety, as so many people have reported disrupted sleep or problems of getting to sleep in the first place. The focus of our conversation today is perhaps an unusual one, sleep in relation to light and architecture. Russell and Ian, how can a neuroscientist and an architect help us to understand the world of sleep and the rhythms that govern our lives? And what can you both learn from each other?
Well, Ian and I have been working together for quite some time. The first project was the Sainsbury Wellcome Centre in London. And I think we met around a table. And of course, I'm a slight geek and I wanted to ask Ian, you know, what's your favourite building? And he said, the Crystal Palace. And I was completely gobsmacked because that's my favourite building. And I was obsessed with it because of this great temple of glass, allowing natural light in to illuminate these extraordinary objects.
Interesting, Russell. My first recollection of meeting you was at the Royal Society. You said, what is your favourite colour?
Oh, yes.
And I replied, 481 nanometers.
Yes, that was spooky.
To which you said, you're one nanometer out, but the brain probably doesn't know it.
And of course, the significance of 480 nanometers is the wavelength of maximum sensitivity of photoreceptors that we discovered in the eye, which are regulating the biological clock and a number of other things. As you and I have discussed, Ian, and there's been this revolution over the past 20 years or so in understanding not only how circadian rhythms tick, but how they're regulated by light. So we have this internal day, the circadian clock, which is fine-tuning every aspect of our physiology and behaviour to the varied demands of the natural light-dark cycle, the 24-hour day. And of course, it's the eye that detects this light-dark cycle and sets the internal clock. But what's turned out to be fascinating is that it's not the visual cells of the eye, the rods and cones, but it's this third photoreceptor we discovered, which is maximally sensitive to blue light of around 480 nanometers or so. But it's more than just the colour and the intensity. What we're also discovering is the rate of change of the light, the time of light exposure, the duration of light exposure. And this will change, and our sensitivities will change as we age. And there's even arguments that the circadian clock changes its sensitivity with different illness states. So, for example, in mental illness, there's a suggestion that in some groups, they might be more sensitive to light and therefore have their circadian rhythms shifted all over the place, and in some cases less sensitive to light. And so with this emerging information, what's exciting is we can start to think about how we can incorporate these new discoveries into building design. So I think that any built space needs to embrace our biology so that an environment optimizes vision, but also optimizes alertness. So it's bright enough for alertness, it's bright enough for regulating the clock and therefore the sleep-wake systems.
I think it's interesting that daylight and windows for architects was more about the view out of the window rather than the amount of light coming in. And there are many examples in the 50s, 60s through the PFI period and building hospitals where windows were placed relatively high to the sleeping position in a ward, so that when the patient sits up to look out the window, they can't see anything. If one approaches an example of a ward and you've got patients who are requiring sleep at different times, possibly because of having had operations, recovery periods, mental state, how does an architect go about designing the lighting for a ward? What would be your first move as an architect? talk to Russell Foster.
If we don't get the light right in our built spaces, whether they be domestic spaces or workspaces, then the consequences of a disrupted circadian and sleep system are severe. So short-term disruption can involve fluctuations in mood, irritability, loss of empathy. You fail to pick up the social signals from friends, family, work colleagues. Risk-taking and doing stupid and unreflective things. So all of those are really quite profound changes in our emotional responses, our ability to focus. It's very interesting. People say, well, it's all about multitasking. It isn't. It's about actually focusing upon all the various options that you've got to. And focusing is very difficult if you're not getting enough sleep. Attention, concentration, decision-making, creativity, productivity, all of these things are hugely affected if you're not getting the right sleep. And then long term, and this is primarily within the night shift community, but there's a great example where I don't think there's any sensible lighting design. What we know is there's increased cardiovascular disease, altered stress responses, type 2 diabetes, lowered immunity, high rates of infection, high rates of cancer. And of course, the big one, depression and psychosis, by not getting the right sort of sleep, which is profoundly influenced by light in our domestic and our workspaces. So not getting sleep is so much more than the inconvenience of feeling tired at the wrong time. It impacts upon our global health. And that's why a dialogue between architects and neuroscientists is so very important, because it's fundamental to human health.
I think it's a cultural issue as well between different cultures based on where you are on the earth. As you go towards the equator, artificial light is whiter. The further north you go to, the Nordic countries, it's more like a candle. They go yellow spectrum. And I think that has something to do with the environment, the overall environment you're in terms of a light environment. And it's embedded in somewhere into one's culture, in one's body. It's not as simple as saying, well, if we do a ward here in, say, Caribbean, and then you apply the same ward design or light design to one in Helsinki, you're going to have the right answer. You won't.
Yes, I think that's a very important point. And just to emphasize, of course, our light environment is immensely dynamic. Changes in intensity, changes in color, in wavelength, changes in the position of the sun in the sky, these are all critical factors. And what the circadian and sleep systems need to do is extract time of day information from that. And because the stimulus is so complicated, we have to think, I think our first principle would be that the sensory systems detecting that complex light environment are also going to be pretty sophisticated, which gets us back to, do we know enough about the light input systems to make clear judgments about human-centric lighting? And I don't think we do. But the problem is, on the basis of what we do know, shouldn't we start to do something now? And so I think that's a bit of the challenge, is how far can architects take this information and embed it in buildings when the story isn't complete?
Well, I think you're absolutely right to actually go for it without an authoritarian viewpoint, because the more buildings that we're designing with a sensitivity, even if it's incomplete, we will get the measure of its success or not. Because there are lots of people out there who are the guinea pigs going into these buildings. And if we were to institute a sort of an understanding, a regime of assessment, then we might get somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The timing of light exposure, of course, is critically important. And the way that you can incorporate that into building design, I think, is going to be really the exciting vanguard in the next decade. And so it's thinking about what light we need during the day in the workspace. But of course, I suppose buildings are used increasingly over 24/7. And so just restricting them to a lighting regime for the daytime would also be naive.
The 24/7 world that we've landed ourselves with is totally contrary to our biology, because we have light when we don't expect it, or the body doesn't expect it. I like the idea of the ceiling being a zen space, a space of total neutrality, not even a fire detector up there. So you can actually look at a part of a room and the space you're in and feel no obligation. It's a bit like silence, visual silence. And that we've managed to succeed to do in a big project in Malta, We have opening windows. We don't have air conditioning. We've used the sun to design the building and the buildings to shade each other. So it shows that if you can get the right daylight level, you get a new type of feeling in the office space. A, you don't need a suspended ceiling. You don't need lights coming from the ceiling. And at night, in the evening, we project onto it from the wall or from the columns. So there's nothing up there other than a beautiful diffused light level.
That's a very interesting point, because essentially what our built spaces have done is detach us from a natural environment. And of course, what I think you want to do is reconnect us with our natural environment.
Yeah, and light is the first part of that. For an architect, it's the first material we use.
And I think the more we learn about the science of sleep and circadian rhythms and the way that light interacts with these systems, the more that can inform advanced architectural design. We're moving away from the fact that sleep is a luxury and an indulgence. And lack of sleep is a socioeconomic issue. And when we were studying 10 to 13, 14-year-olds, we asked the question, does anybody share your sleeping space? The question we didn't ask is, do you have a bed? And as a result of these discussions, we realized that many of these children were sleeping on the family sofa while the television was going on and the parents were there. And the people who are doing night shift work and are chronically tired, the children who are failing at school because they're chronically tired. And I don't think we've paid enough attention to the fact that deprivation of sleep is a socioeconomic issue, and indeed it's something that architecture could address.
Thanks very much to Russell Foster and Ian Ritchie. This was the first episode of a new podcast brought to you by Sleep and the Rhythms of Life Project at the University of Oxford. The producer is Ruth Abrahams from Feast Collective Productions.
Music by Madeleine Morris.
Thanks for listening, and goodbye.